John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton. It's time for the Report Card with the Professor.
Oh, okay, good. I didn't just, it's the first time I heard the music here, so I didn't know if we were on off. So here we go. And of course, what we do is we go and take a look at the report card. We grade the good, the bad, the ugly, the smart, the dumb, all the things that are going on, because there are some crazy things that we get to judge. And so, Maura Dooley, what do we got?
Well, John, first up, we have some people are pretty impressed with when LeBron was asked what went wrong in the game last night. He gave such a vivid recall of what happened that they've now matched it up with videos from the game, and his memory is very impressive.
We ran him the first possession. We ran him down all the way to 2 on the shot clock. Marcus Morris missed a jump shot, followed it up. They got a dunk. We came back down. We ran a set for Jordan Clarkson, and he came off and missed it. They rebounded it. And we came back on the defensive end, and we got a stop. They took it out on the sideline. Jason Tatum took the ball out, threw it to Marcus Smart in the short corner. He made a three. We come back down, miss another shot. And then Tatum came down and went 94 feet, did a Euro step, and made a right-hand layup timeout. There you go.
Wow, that is pretty impressive. I mean, he was able to get all the mistakes. I know that one of the first things he said, he talked about his 7 turnovers that he'd had, and he had a bad game. And I tell you what, first off, you have to give him an A for the way he's played through this series. I mean, what, averaging 34 some points a game? He's just been dominating. And you wondered, was the fatigue factor going to get to him? And certainly it was the defense. And I know when I was looking at it, because I started to go into some of my into my geeky metrics and stuff like that, and started to look at some of the ratings, and I started to see that Boston had first a younger group out there. Now, again, the Cavs, with the moves that they made with like 3 trades that they have now in their top 6 players, they got a little bit younger. But then you look at the youth and the talent that's still there, despite the fact that Kyrie Irving is not playing and the fact that their best 2 players are out. I'm now thinking the Celtics are going to kind of win, and this could be very frustrating for LeBron and get him moving to whatever Los Angeles franchise that he wants to go to. So I guess he gets an A, and I think you can hear in his voice that he needs his players to step up and do more, because he's done everything and this game was just flat.
Well, along those lines, next up we'll go to Stephen A. Smith had an interesting take on maybe why the Cavs struggled yesterday.
It's almost like you want a good night's sleep, right? But you sleep a little bit too long, get a few extra hours, and you just wake up sluggish. It was tantamount to that because the Cavs had enough time off. Everybody was talking about how well rested LeBron was. And as a result, he couldn't do anything, and it had a contagious effect the rest of the team followed.
Were they just too well rested, Professor?
I can't imagine that. I think that what I worried is once it finally catch up to him. Because, I mean, you could even see in the last couple games, now again, having the 5-game series gave him a few extra days off, but, I mean, a couple of those games, you could tell at the very end how tired he was and how fatigued he was. I mean, he was not short with his answers, because he's very good at answering all the questions, but Stephen A., I think I have to kind of give you a C- on this one, because, I mean, they did not look rested. They just looked tired, out of sorts, and, not disinterested, but just bad. I mean, they looked awful out there in the court. And so I think when you put all that together, you can see that they could be in trouble. And the other thing I look at, too, Brad Stevens is a great coach. And I think that you can see that there's a good chance the Celtics are going to outcoach the Cavs. And so now you have LeBron facing a more talented team despite 2 injuries and taking on so much. I think this could go the Cavs' way. But give a C- to Stephen A. on that.
Yeah, it's tough to count LeBron out. And he's definitely in his history had some slow starts like this and come back. But the Celtics' defense is it's smothering right now.
It really is, and that's what I think. And you can see that he came up, Brad, with some great matchups on defense that really put them in a good position and put the Cavs in a horrible spot.
Yeah. All right, next up we have Colin Cowherd making a comparison of Lamar Jackson to Tim Tebow.
I have predicted, and I'll say it again, Tebow 2.0 is coming, and it's already starting today. It's Lamar Jackson. And they've got a lot of similarities. Lamar Jackson, the story is today, he texted, he called Joe Flacco, and Flacco wouldn't return his call. It makes Flacco look unprofessional. It makes Lamar Jackson look more likable and relatable. He's a good kid, and the veterans being a snob. Oh, boy, here we go. First of all, Lamar and Tebow have absolutely five or six similarities you can't deny. They're three-year starters in college, so they come to the NFL with a brand. Okay, they're big names now. They're going to sell it. Tebow led the NFL in jersey sales, I think, as a rookie. Lamar Jackson may lead the NFL in jersey sales as a rookie. They come in as brands. Secondly, they're Heisman winners, so they've been elevated. The third thing is they're both first-round picks. It would be different if Tebow and Lamar were fifth-round picks, but once you're a first-round pick, there is this sense that, hey, when are we going to play this guy? You're paying him all this money. Number four is they both have styles that are not prototypical for quarterbacks that win Super Bowls. They run a lot.
I cut him off after four.
But yeah. What's he talking about? It's like, how grandiose is it to make any comparison to Tim Tebow, who could not play in the National Football League? I mean, so what's he? We're comparing sales and stuff like that. I mean, Lamar Jackson, I think in time, can be a very good quarterback. And so I'm not going to dismiss that. But to compare anybody to Tim Tebow, the quarterback, is just ridiculous. F going right now to Colin Cowherd on this one.
All right, last up we have Josh Norman was being interviewed about Dancing with the Stars. They asked him if the pressure could compare to the Super Bowl, and he said yes.
Or the Super Bowl.
Man, look, you can't even sit up here and say that. They're two different things.
Well, you're comfortable going on a football field, so I'm not sure there's much pressure there. I'm just wondering, that pressure playing under that spotlight, anything compared?
Absolutely. It's Super Bowl. Oh, my gosh. If you can be here with me as they go through, it's just a different type of pressure because your heart's racing, man, with anxiety, just really ready to get out there and put it out all on the dance floor in front of millions of people watching, right? And then you got a couple hundred in the audience.
He kind of mumbled there, but in the transcription of the second part, he did say it is a Super Bowl of, I think maybe he was meant of Dancing with the Stars, but
I would have to think
interesting,
that
interesting, since he's been in one.
I mean, the pressure is there, but I mean, compared to a Super Bowl, that's a C minus. I mean, what is he? That just doesn't make much sense. I mean, the Super Bowl, with all the millions of people that are watching. Yeah, I know a lot of people watch Dancing with the Stars. My wife does. You probably do. And a lot of people enjoy it, and that's great. But I mean, Super Bowl is about as good as it gets. And I think you can see, particularly with the most recent Super Bowls, the games have been better than ever. And so to compare it to a Super Bowl, and it's like, nah, I just don't get that. So I think we got to give a bad grade on that one.
Yeah. I actually don't watch that show. I don't know how he's doing. We'll have to ask Pat.
Yeah, Pat will know very much, of course. You can check out the show in the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Coming up, we're moving up your text questions. Gary Wright will be joining us at 11:30 to talk about Chuck Knox. It's the John Clayton Show on 710. Oh, by the way, text us at 710-710. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Hey, this is Bob Stelton from the Bob Gross and Tom Show. I want to thank you for listening to the John Clayton Show. And you know what would be great is if you checked out the Bob Gross and Tom Show every day from noon to 3. You can stream us live at 710sports.com or on the 710 Sports app or listen on demand.
You're listening to the Professor John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And normally we do this at 11:30. We moved it up about 15 minutes or so to take your text questions. So text us, because I know you have a lot of stuff going on. I mean, first off, the passing of Chuck Knox, reacting to that, the news coming from the Supreme Court that you can have legalized gambling on sports in each state that would want it. You have that. Mariners now have officially made the move. Robinson Cano goes on the DL, and they did bring up Gordon Beckham, who is batting 300 down in Tacoma, so it looks like he'll play second base to fill in for Robinson Cano. That D. Gordon stays out in center field. That seems to be the plan for now. But give us your text questions at 710-710, and what do we have, Maura?
First up, the 509 wants to know, Professor, do you have a favorite funny memory of Chuck Knox?
Mm, I mean, the funny ones that I look at is that, you know, really watching him coach. I mean, you know, it was kind of funny when, you know, because I still love the beginning of camp because, I mean, when he would put his hat on backwards and he'd start to get in there with the offensive linemen and, you know, sometimes bloody his forehead and all that stuff. I mean, that was always fun. I mean, certainly just the, you know, the press conferences when he talked about Dave Craig and, you know, said all the great things of how he was one of the great quarterbacks and all that. And I thought that was kind of fun. I guess, you know, just, you know, the big memories is just, you know, how good he was to deal with. I mean, I loved the conversation we had about how much he liked Brett Favre and how much he was hoping for him. So I think, you know, those are some of the ones that I kind of remember.
So he got in there and was mixing it up with the linemen?
Yeah. Showing him how to block, you know. It's like, get in there and get it, you know, take that hat back. And it's like, show him to get into the face of the guys. That was always fun.
That's awesome. 206 wants to know if you think the Seahawks get a contract extension done or franchise tag Russell.
I think it's going to be on Russell. No, I think that they'll get something done. I mean, it's not going to be easy. There's no question about that. It's going to be very difficult, but I still think in the end they can do that and get something. So just stay tuned on that one. But again, it's so far down the line right now because you're talking nothing's going to happen this year and nothing is going to happen until they get something done with Aaron Rodgers. So just stay tuned. But in the end, I think they will get something done.
253 says, do the Mariners have any shot of making the playoffs now that Robinson Cano is out of the lineup?
Well, they still have a shot, but now that shot gets a little bit tougher because you're taking away your number three hitter on All-Star. I mean, I you know, what's the wins against replacement? Three or four for a Robinson Cano? So I think it's going to be tougher, and you know, it's not going to be easy. And the tough part is right now that you know where the wild cards are coming from. You know, one's probably coming from the East, whether it's going to be the Yankees or the Boston Red Sox. I mean, they're playing at 700 level, and right now it's going to be harder to catch the Angels because the Angels right now have a great shot to do it. It's funny, there's only like seven winning teams right now with winning records in baseball, which I find very amazed. I'm just kind of surprised at all that. You know, it's such a, you know, you have your haves and your have-nots, and Seattle can still be a have, but it's going to be tougher without Robinson Cano.
509 wants to know if you've ever worked on a farm or wanted to.
I've never worked on the farm and having no desire to work on a farm. Too much work. I mean, it's like that's something that I had no desire to do. I kind of grew up, I grew up in Braddock and Forest Hills, you know, kind of in suburbs and tough areas and all that stuff. But no, I've never had a desire to work on a farm.
I don't blame you. That is a lot of hard work. A lot of early rising, too.
Yes.
253 says Coach Knox had a player that was with them all three NFL stops. Jimmy Jodat was one of my favorite players. He played offensive, special teams, and defense. Do you know what happened to him?
I do not know. Maybe Gary Wright will be joining us here at the bottom of the hour. Maybe he knows what happened to Gary Jodat. So do not know the answer to that one.
360 says, yo, good morning, John. Love the show. Hey, do you think the pitch that hit Robbie Cano was intentional?
I don't think so. I mean, there didn't seem to be that kind of a backlash. I mean, they, you know, never did hear of anything like that. So I would tend to think not. It was just an 88-mile-an-hour pitch that just caught him at a bad spot.
253 wants to know what kind of meat you had at Daniel's on Friday.
I had chicken, garlic chicken. Although, thanks to Brock, I was able to get a very nice steak appetizer.
Wonderful.
That was Brock Heward, who really stepped up at Daniel's. So it was great.
That's so nice of him. Let's see. The 360 says, do you think with legalized gambling in sports that will open up a spot for Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame?
No. I don't think the voters will change their opinions, and I don't think the league's going to change their opinions. And so, no, I don't think it does do that. I mean, that what's in the past is in the past. It's unfortunate because he should be in the Hall of Fame. He was a Hall of Fame player, but I don't see that changing anything for Pete Rose.
Eric from the 253 wants to know who you think will be the Seahawks Rookie of the Year next season.
I think it could be Rashad Perry. I mean, Penny. I think that Penny.
Rashad
Penny, because I think that he's going to probably gain 900 yards or so. I think he can have a chance to have a pretty good season. So if he would be the one candidate that I would put up there.
I feel like he's the one we're hearing the most about. Everyone we talk to, even though people thought he might go later, seems to really love him. I can't wait to actually see him in game.
Mm-hmm.
206 says, if the M's don't make the playoffs, is DePoto in the hot seat?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that he's too good at what he does. I mean, you can see the improvements on this year's team and the fact that they're at least in the race. And, you know, hey, he tried to get Ohtani. I mean, he had the right instinct on doing it. It's just that Ohtani, I mean, that's probably the one difference right now that could keep them from being in the playoffs, the fact that Ohtani's done so well and has put the Angels atop over the Mariners. And so that one, I think, has worked against him. But again, he tried. It just didn't work out.
425 says, if Earl bails at the end of the season, do they get a high compensatory pick?
Third round. You know, third round pick. I mean, of course, that would be in 2020, but yeah, figuring he's going to get over $13 million, they would get a third round compensatory.
253 wants to know, who would be your first pick in fantasy football this year?
I'd still, the wide receiver, I still think Antonio Brown. And, you know, you have to look at two of the Steelers. I mean, I kind of get the feeling that Bell is going to drop off a little bit, Le'Veon Bell, because I think, you know, but they're going to use him a lot because it's probably going to be his last year. So I'd take one of the two of the Steelers, whether it's going to be Le'Veon Bell, who I think may drop off a little bit, or Antonio Brown.
360 says, hi, John. Why didn't the Seahawks bring back or sign Kaysen Williams before the Colts did? Granted, his success in the preseason was in the preseason, mm-hmm. but he's a wide receiver that has a gamer attitude.
I don't know. Maybe Kaysen's taken the attitude that you know, they cut him and he didn't want to go back with them. I would have to think that they made the phone call because he did so well at camp. A lot of people were angry that he didn't make the team and Amara Darbo made the team, which, of course, you can see Darbo's got a great future ahead of him. So maybe he just didn't want to come back. I don't know. Good question.
206 wants to know what beach in L.A. you would suggest.
I'm big on Santa Monica. I really like Santa Monica, but you can't go too far. Because the great part about Santa Monica, I mean, you jog a mile and now you're on Venice Beach, and Venice Beach is great. So I really like the you know, the chance to get out there on any beach. I just wish I could make vacation this year. I just don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately.
Crossing my fingers for you.
Yeah, I think it's going to... You can cross them, but I think the odds are against it.
Oh. 206 wants to know whatever happened to Sean Alexander.
Well, we talked to him a few months ago, and I think he's living in Virginia, but he's having a great life right now. You know, certainly he's been honored by the Seahawks and all that, but I think he's just having a good family life. And I think he hasn't gotten into the ministry, but I know he's been very religious in some of the adventures that he has.
All right, one last one here. 360 says, wants to know what you think about Todd Gurley for a first round fantasy pick.
I think he could be a good... Oh, no, he's a great one because he's one of the best backs in the league. I mean, you know, the one that I think is going to be interesting to see is Saquon Barkley and how he kind of goes in there and fits, because, I mean, you figure he's going to be automatically good. So, I mean, any of these running backs. But, no, I think if you're looking at a good running back, Todd Gurley is sensational.
All right, that's it for text today.
Okay, you can check out the show on the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Well, coming up, we're going to talk to Gary Wright about Chuck Knox, what he meant to the team, and stories that, you know, only he would know and talk about. Gary Wright, the former PR director of the Seahawks. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On demand with the 710 Seattle Sports app.
Joining us in the Venue Kings Hotline, former PR director of the Seahawks, Gary Wright. And so, Gary, I mean, you were there for the entire Chuck Knox regime. I mean, you've been associated with, you know, Jackie Sherrill has been a good friend of yours that you know so well, Jerry Tarkanian. What was so special about Chuck Knox?
Well, first of all, it's a sad, you know, it's a sad day to have be talking about this. But at the same time, when I hear other people talk about Chuck, it just brings a smile to my face and just... such great, happy memories, and the fact that, you know, he took a franchise and, you know, brought it into the limelight and got us into the playoffs and had great players. And he was a special, special guy to so many of us.
Yeah. What was it like when he first got here? Because he had such a persona when he was hired in 1983. Tell us the circumstances and what kind of reaction was there.
Well, I'll tell you two things. First, my initial reaction, the press conference that he had, was preceded by a staff meeting where he called the entire staff in, and he just kind of laid out his philosophy and talked about the fact that every person in this room had something to do with us winning or losing. It didn't mean it didn't matter what your job was, if you were cleaning out the lockers or you were the offensive coordinator. Everybody was important. Everybody had a job to do, and everybody was accountable. And he approached things that way. And, you know, he just got you fired up all the time. I can remember us getting a player from the Raiders. And after his first meeting, he told me I was ready to run through the wall just listening to the guy talk. He had just so much presence. When he walked into the room, he just commanded presence.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, he was so good. What were some of the special things that you watched him as a coach or maybe at a press conference say? Some of your favorite anecdotes about Chuck?
Well, some of my favorite ones, I mean, for instance, his attention to detail was amazing. Two little things I can remember about that. I mean, so many things I can remember, but two things kind of jump out. One, we were going to go on our first road trip, and I was the advance man, and so I had to make sure everything was ready for the team and promote the game, a lot different than it is today. But the advance man was there for three, 4 days in advance of the team. And Chuck said, now, when I was in the Rams, the advance man one time did not check the curtains in my bedroom, and I had to sleep in the bathroom in the tub. And I'm thinking to myself, now, there's no way that possibly happened. But what it is, it's a story for effect to say, check every little detail and don't let anything, you know, go uncovered. And that's the way he approached coaching. For instance, he had behind his desk, he had a big credenza. And in the credenza, he had all these notebooks, stenograph notebooks. And every day when he was going to meet with the team, he would write down what he was going to talk about kind of in bullet points and then elaborate from that. But I asked him one time, you know, how come you have all these old ones? And he had them all the way back from the start of his head coaching days. And he said, because I want to remember what I told the team in this situation. If we were going to face this kind of opponent, or we were on a three-game winning streak, or this happened, I want to know what I told the team then. And I also want to remember what I told the team the first time we played this opponent this year and things like that. So every single meeting he went to, he kept meticulous notes, but then he kept those notes forever and always referred back to them.
That's amazing. I would imagine, too, I mean, you probably were at so many of them. Some of the speeches he had to the team, I mean, how inspiring were they? Some of the ones that you remember the best.
Well, I always made it a practice not to sit in on team meetings and things like that, because I didn't think that was my place. That was for the players and the coaches. But I just, you could always tell the reaction of the players when they'd come out of those meetings. He would always have them fired up, ready to go, no matter what it was. I mean, they never left the game on the field, the practice field on Wednesday or Thursday, getting them that fired up. But he just had a way about doing that. The one thing I can remember, I went to a lot of his speaking engagements, and it was the same kind of thing, though, that when he would talk to an audience, he could get them all fired up and enthused about the Seahawks. And he also had a way of communicating in their own way. For instance, I took him to the Italian club one time in Seattle, and all of a sudden he gets up there and he's throwing out Italian phrases, and these guys are going crazy. And I said to him after, I said, where'd you come up with this? He goes, you got to know your audience. So, you know, every day, honestly, every day you learn something from Chuck. If you didn't, you weren't paying attention.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because he was well schooled, and of course, I mean, he had been in so many places. I mean, you know, how involved he was in trying to get Joan Namath to go to the New York Jets. I mean, that story was just remarkable. I mean, what is it as far as his coaching that had him so successful at three different franchises?
Well, again, I think it's the attention. I think it was the attention to detail and having a philosophy. He knew how he wanted to win the games. He knew if each opponent obviously is different, and he knew if he had to shorten the game this week or if we were going to have to throw the ball on occasion. He knew how to approach every single game, every single season, and he could adjust. He could go from a 4-3 to a 3-4, depended on what his personnel was like. But he also knew what kind of personnel he wanted, and that's why he made the trade for Kurt Warner in our first season, trading away our first, second, and third to get a running back out of Penn State. And of course, on that little running back's first carry, he went 80 yards. So kind of knew what he was talking about.
Yeah. Well, as you would watch him, I still remember some of the things that he would do with at the early part of practice in the training camp, and that putting that hat backwards and going with the offensive lineman and trying to get down with them. I mean, that was
absolutely
just incredible.
I am sure that he got a headache every once in a while by turning that hat backwards and butting his head into a player. But it was for effect. He used to say that if there was a hair on my head that knew what I was thinking, I would pluck it out. But I guarantee you, he was two or three moves ahead of everybody all the time. And that's one of the things that made him special. He thought out everything in advance.
Mm-hmm. And he was so good. And he also had such a great coaching staff.
Great coaching staff?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? You find that the great coaches surround themselves with greatness, and they're not afraid to give credit to those great assistant coaches, and he did. He had some great coaches.
Yeah, he really did. I mean, Tom Catlin was so good on defense. I mean, he had George Dyer. I mean, it was really such a good staff and a fun staff to watch.
And a fun staff to be around. I mean, those are some of my absolute best friends. I heard Dave Wyman this morning talking about what a great coach Tom Catlin was. It's interesting. Tom Catlin was the perfect defensive coordinator. He had no interest in being a head coach. He didn't want to be a head coach. He wanted to be the defensive coordinator and worked for Chuck for so long, with the Rams, with Buffalo, and then here. So he did. He surrounded himself with great coaches.
Because you were with the franchise from the very beginning, just talk about how when he got here and how it just elevated things in this city. I mean, how much did his presence and his success put everything on the map for the Seahawks?
Well, I think, to start with, the Seahawks started out with a bang. I mean, sold 59,000 season tickets in a month. And, the excitement was there. The excitement was there even in the first few years. I mean, Jim Zorn running around throwing to Steve Largent. So there was that love affair with the team. I think we went 9-7 in the third year, which is the fastest at that time an expansion team had ever done anything like that. But then, the realization became, through the 82 season, we hadn't made the playoffs. And so interest was there, but it kind of waned from the fervor of the early years. And he changed that immediately and changed that with the tone of his voice in interviews and with his tone of his voice in the locker room. And everywhere he went, he had so much enthusiasm, so much confidence, and that just came out, and then the players took it from there.
Mm-hmm. No doubt, and it was just so much fun to watch the success of the team and how he was able to get that. And, of course, when you got to the championship game, AFC championship game, was really kind of the high mark for him and the franchise at that time.
Well, it was, and that was certainly an interesting championship game. I mean, we had beaten them. We had beaten the Raiders twice during the regular season. And then in that championship game before 90-something thousand people in the L.A. Coliseum, just couldn't get it done and get to that next step. But then the following year, in the first game, Kurt Warner blew out his knee, and I can remember Chuck talking to the players right then and said that, you know, as great as Kurt Warner is, and we all love him, you know, Kurt Warner doesn't block, Kurt Warner doesn't throw the ball, Kurt Warner doesn't play defense. Every one of us is going to have to step up just a little bit more and make up for that loss of this great player. And then we went 12-4 and made the playoffs again.
Fantastic. Gary, it was great catching up with you and getting some stories on Chuck Knox. Again, his passing at the age of 86 yesterday, a great loss for us. But again, it's just great to go back and get the memories of what Chuck Knox meant. Gary, thanks for joining us in the Venue Kings Hotline.
Well, thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Hi, Gary Wright, of course. And of course, you can check out the show on the 710 Sports app. It's driven by your Puget Sound Acura dealer. Coming up next, we catch up with Dave Crosby.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
And joining us now is Dave Crosby. And wow, what a weekend and what a lot of things to talk about. I guess first off, we talk about your memories of Chuck Knox, who passed yesterday at the age of 86.
Unfortunately, John, I got here after Chuck Knox was already gone. So okay. I don't really have any memories to share. He was Tom Flores was the coach when I arrived, so... Interviewed him once or twice, but never really got to know him, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Tell you what, he was special. I mean, he came and he had that presence that was just, I mean, he was all coach. And, of course, his success was almost automatic as soon as he got to any of the new teams, whether it was the Rams, Buffalo, or Seattle. Just did such a great job. So, again, he will be missed, and we'll give details later on of what's going to be going on with Chuck Knox. All right, of course, the big ruling today came down from the Supreme Court, 6-3 ruling at the that sports gambling can happen now on sporting events. It's up to each state to be able to do it. I guess there's one little caveat that Congress can kind of overrule everything. And I think you can see the National Football League still kind of, you know, trying to fight this a little bit because they want to try to get to Congress and see how they can try to legislate it. But I think Congress isn't going to take this up.
Well, Congress can't overrule it, so that's not what can happen. But Congress can regulate it, and they will probably do something. There's already experience in this with. Lotteries are in 44 states. Casino gambling is in like 25 or 30 states. There are some federal restrictions, but they pretty much allow state governments to handle the local legislation. So there'll be some involvement, but you know, that's what the NFL wants them to come in and regulate it at least. And they will to a degree, but I wouldn't expect too much of it.
No, I think that it's going to be pretty well hands off. And, you know, what we're talking about now is could have 5 or 6 states be able to have something by the start of the football season.
Well, New Jersey, certainly. This was actually a case against the state of New Jersey filed. And they already have, I believe, the Monmouth Racetrack. They've already got a sports book ready. It just need to turn on the lights. So they've already put up the framework. That's why they took it to the Supreme Court to challenge the case. They've already got their infrastructure in place. There's a few other places that do as well. For most places, it'll be a period of time. I think there's 20, 25 states or so that have already kind of investigated it a little bit, have put forward bills in the past. So they're already on the path to doing it. And there are a lot of states, many more, who have not, including Washington State, which has taken no steps towards legalizing sports gambling.
Yeah, what do you think? Do you think Washington State will not do this?
Oh, no, I think everyone will do it except for Utah and maybe Alabama. It'll just take time. It'll just take time. I mean, I would not expect it to happen tomorrow in Washington State. I would expect it to take a couple of years for it to happen. But the only states where I don't see it happening are Utah and Alabama.
Yeah, I guess the one thing that has to kind of be to work out here in the state is that, you know, the casinos, of course, with the Indian reservations and all that stuff. I mean, that could be a little bit of a deterrent to slow things down.
Really, the only thing they can do is lobby. I mean, it's like anything political at this time. So they can lobby. The pro sports teams can lobby. The tribes can lobby, but I don't know how effective that's going to be. It's not that different than the medical marijuana thing, really, where there's in this case, though, the federal government is opposed to it, but they allow the states to legislate it for themselves. So it'll come down to state politics, and we know when politics is involved, especially in Washington State, things tend to move slowly. So there'll be lots of people in on the pie. You know, there's a they'll be in for tax revenues locally and in states. At the same time, that will impact the betting lines that they set up. So, and remember, I mean, for those who think this is going to have a big impact on sports, I would just say that they estimate that $150 billion was gambled illegally last year on sports. It's not going to have any impact whatsoever negatively on sports. Now, I think the people that are going to be gambling are the ones who are already gambling for the most part. It'll enhance television coverage. It'll enhance franchise values. The leagues themselves aren't really going to fight it at all. They're just trying to get a piece of the pie because that's what they do. But from that standpoint, there are a lot of winners in this deal.
One loser over the weekend was the Mariners, who lost two out of three to Detroit, and Robinson Cano today goes on the disabled list. How damaging is that going to be?
Well, we'll see. They've overcome injuries beforehand. It's better than an injury to their pitching staff, where they're a lot thinner. They withstood the loss of Nelson Cruz for a while. Their cleanup hitter, Cano, is a little more valuable in that he is a significant aspect in the field as well. So you're losing one of the best defensive second basemen. And with all due respect to Cruz, Cano's really the de facto leader of this team. So it's damaging for sure. And then the Mariners, like you said, struggled in Detroit. Their first road series loss. But they get 16 of their next 20 games at home after today's game with Minnesota. So they got a chance to rest up. And the thing with Cano is we'll see what it is. I mean, he's going to go on to Philadelphia, I guess, from Minneapolis and have it looked at. He referred to it himself as a bad break. This could be a month. This could be 2 months. This could be longer than that. So it all kind of depends on how long he's out for. But the Mariners have a really deep lineup. So in terms of offense, they should still be able to produce.
And Gordon Beckham was called up from Tacoma, so he's going to take over at second base. D. Gordon staying in the outfield, but they do have the option of putting Gordon at second if necessary.
Yeah, and I think that if Cano is out for a significant period of time, they should really, really think about that. You know, he's an all-star second baseman, for crying out loud. I mean, I understand you were changing his position and you want to kind of stick with that, but Heredia is a much better option out there long-term than I think Mr. Beckham is at second base if he's going to be starting there, or Taylor Motter or whatnot. So I think if they get into lineup troubles, if Cano is out for a couple of months, you may see them revisit this. At this point, though, obviously they want to keep Gordon in center field, and they're going to try and utilize probably a variety of guys at second base.
Yeah, and then, of course, Cavaliers get off to a horrible start, losing game one by more than 20. Didn't even look very competitive. And I've kind of flipped. I was thinking maybe as they were getting hot that they were all set. I'm not flipping. I'm going to go with Boston.
John, all you do is flip on the Cavaliers. You flip and you flop. They lost by 34 to Indiana in the first round. I would not view one game in Boston as, well, they're finished. They certainly don't have home court advantage. They need to get one game in Boston. They win game two, the series completely turns on its head. So I'll wait and see what happens, but not to take away from the fact that Boston, without a couple of starters, played great.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really having a terrific, terrific postseason.
Well, and what I kind of looked at closely yesterday is that Brad Stevens is such a good coach. I do think that could be one of the factors, because I think he can out-coach Cleveland.
Well, I mean, coaching is one thing, but it's the NBA. It comes down to the players.
Right.
You've seen some guys who aren't considered great coaches win NBA championships. So I'm not going to go that far. But I do think Stevens is a terrific coach.
He really was. And, of course, he didn't get coach of the year. The coach of the year is one.
He didn't even get a vote.
Didn't even get a vote. Yeah, 59 wins, and all of a sudden you get fired. Because you couldn't beat Cleveland.
Yeah, that was Dwayne Casey's lot, who sent a nice classy letter to the fans of Toronto I saw over the weekend, too.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine he should get hired very quickly, because this guy's a good, good coach.
Yes, I would think so, too, John. I would think that, he's got a year left on his deal that'll pay him $6.5 million, so if he wants to take a year off, he can certainly do that, but he will have no problem getting another job in the NBA.
Hey, so what's on Bob Grouse and Tom today?
We'll talk a little bit more about the gambling decision, and also a guy who played for Chuck Knox, and I think coached for them. Well, I think he just played for him, Paul Moyer. I don't think Paul was a coach under Chuck. I think he just was a player under Chuck. He'll talk to us at 2 o'clock.
Okay, and that's Bob Graz and Tom coming up next. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. Maura Dooley, thank you for producing the show. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.